From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, screenwriter and director Wes Anderson tells us about the inspiration behind his comedy Rushmore. It's about a 15-year-old prep school student who loves his school, is the head of every team, but is placed on sudden-death academic probation. Anderson also co-wrote and directed the film Bottle Rocket. Also, the sequel to Get Shorty. We talk with Elmore Leonard about his new novel, Be Cool. It brings back Chili Palmer, the small-time Brooklyn loan shark who became a Hollywood movie producer. This time he's making a movie about the record industry. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Charlotte Gray, the World War II novel by Sebastian Fox, the author of Birdsong. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Wes Anderson, directed and co-wrote the new comedy Rushmore. Our film critic John Powers described it as pulling off the miraculous feat of being a completely fresh teen comedy. For Rushmore, Anderson won the New Generation Filmmaker Award from the L.A. Film Critics Association. He won the MTV Best New Filmmaker Award in 1996 for his first film, Bottle Rocket. Rushmore stars Jason Schwartzman as Max Fisher, a 10th grader at Rushmore Academy. He's a scholarship student who's the head of every club, loves the school, but flunks out anyways and ends up in public school. He's also fallen in love with Miss Cross, a teacher at Rushmore, and has enlisted one of the school's benefactors, played by Bill Murray, to help win her over. But Murray's fallen in love with her, too. Here they are at a restaurant, celebrating the success of a new play by Max that he's just staged at his public school. Max is angry that the teacher he has a crush on has brought along a date.
I like your nurse's uniform, guy.
These are OR scrubs.
Oh, are they? Well, they're totally inappropriate for the occasion.
Well, I didn't know we were going to dinner.
That's because you weren't invited.
Take it easy, Max.
You were the one that ordered him a whiskey and soda.
So what's wrong with that? I can write a hit play. Why can't I have a little drink to unwind myself? So tell me, Curly, how do you know Miss Cross?
We went to Harvard together.
Oh, that's great. I wrote a hit play and directed it. So I'm not sweating it either.
Can we get a check, please?
What do you think you're doing?
Getting a check.
No, you're not. Excuse me. I just want to thank you for accommodating us. You see, we only thought we were going to be three, but someone invited himself along, so I apologize.
It's quite all right, sir.
Okay.
Very well.
You're being rude, Max.
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not. I'm just trying to figure out why you brought this gentleman to my play and my dinner, which was invitation only. Would you like me to pass you the creamer, dog?
Yes, please.
What is wrong with you?
What is wrong with you? You hurt my feelings. This night was important to me.
How did I hurt your feelings?
Oh, my God! I wrote a hit play! And I'm in love with you.
Now, Rushmore is really dependent on having a terrific young actor who can play a 15-year-old, and I think that must be hard to find. You were really lucky. You found someone really terrific in Jason Schwartzman. Were you worried, though, for a while that it would be hard to find someone who was really good and could play a 15-year-old?
Yeah, well, we spent a year trying to find somebody to play that part, and we really had no movie if we didn't have someone great. And what happened was after all this time, and we'd searched all over America, we eventually were searching in Canada. We had casting directors in every state, and then eventually we opened it up to England. Me and my co-writer Owen Wilson had decided that we could have an English actor who would be doing a fake English accent to play the character, which would actually be a real English accent, but in the context of the movie it would be fake. We'd gotten that desperate that we were coming up with those kind of ideas. And then this kid Jason Schwartzman came in, and I just knew he was nothing like what I had sort of planned. You know, I thought we were physically looking for a 15-year-old Mick Jagger, and he was sort of a 15-year-old Dustin Hoffman kind of. But then as soon as he did the scene, you know, we you know, he auditioned and read a scene, and then I just felt like we had him. And I realized that the main thing I was looking for was someone who was 15 years old or 16 years old who had the sort of presence and force to carry, to be the center of a movie. And that's what I'd been sort of waiting for. And all the other ideas of the preconceptions of what it ought to be like, were I threw them out the window as soon as I realized I had someone who could kind of be the star of a movie.
Now, Schwartzman is Talia Shear's son, and Talia Shear is what Francis Coppola's sister, and plays the sister of Al Pacino in the Godfather movies. So
right,
he
right.
must have been at least acquainted with movies.
He'd been on some sets, but he wasn't really brought up around. I don't know. He tells it that he didn't grow up on movie sets. I know he visited them. But he'd never acted before.
Mm-hmm.
But he'd obviously been around creative people all his life.
Now you also cast Bill Murray in the role of the self-made tycoon who becomes Max's helper and then his rival. Why did you see Bill Murray in the role? Bill Murray's great. Did he ask to be in the film, or did you approach him?
It was someone that we had in mind when we were writing the script. And we had always thought that he was, you know, we weren't going to be able to afford him, or we weren't going to be able to get access to him. And those things just proved to be wrong. And I'd always loved him in there's some movies where he's doing something very different from his sort of comic persona. Like Ed Wood or Mad Dog and Glory, Tootsie, Razor's Edge also, and so it was sort of with those performances in mind. And then when I met him, I thought that he had all kinds of things that we could sort of draw on for the character and kind of tap into. He'd never had a family in a movie before. And he's got, you know, he's got five kids, and he's been a father for 17 years or something. So there were all kinds of things like that, and I'm always excited to see him in an unusual role. So all those things kind of fed into it.
Did he do much improvising within the film?
We didn't, because I thought it was going to be a thing where we just hand him the scene and step back, and he kind of wings it, which I think he's done on lots of movies. But you know, as soon as we started working on it, we started to feel like there was a story that we wanted to tell that was in the script. And you know, Owen and I had worked hard on the script, and we sort of felt good about it. And then Bill kind of agreed with that, and we just sort of stuck to the script. You know, very, very quickly we sort of figured that out.
There's a scene when he's at a party in his own home in the backyard by the pool, but he's so alienated from the party that he climbs up on the diving board with a cigarette and a glass of scotch in his hand and then just kind of like dives in and probably plans
There's
on staying underwater until he sees a kid swimming around there. Was that all in the script?
Yeah, that was in the script. That was sort of a scene that was... The first half of the scene was sort of a Cheever kind of thing, of a midlife crisis kind of alcoholic haze. And then the second half of the scene is, I think, steals a little bit from The Graduate. Because there's a scene in The Graduate where Dustin Hoffman is... He's given a birthday present, and it's a diving suit, and he jumps in the water, and then he just stays down there away from the party that his parents are throwing for him. And that's kind of what Bill Murray does in this scene. He just stays under.
Even though the film is set in the present and the center of the film is a 15-year-old, a lot of the records that you use in the movie are from the 60s, including Chad and Jeremy's Summer Song, which I thought was an unusual choice. Why so many 60s records, and particularly why that one?
Yeah, well, initially my plan was to score the whole movie with songs by the Kinks, because I sort of felt like the character that he's playing is he sees himself as a total establishment figure. And, you know, I think he wants to be headmaster of the school one day. But what's really going on in his mind is all the usual kind of teenage, adolescent, angsty kind of anger and everything. And so that's why, you know, the Kinks would not be the music that he would listen to, but it would be sort of his emotional state. And then I sort of expanded it to the whole British invasion because I started doing some research on it. And that Chad and Jeremy song was just one where I listened to the song and it made me think of a whole montage for the story. So I just kind of figured out the visuals to go with that song. I sort of felt like it belonged at a certain point in the story. So that one actually kind of inspired the sequence that it goes with.
And you didn't think it was unusual to have music from a different period than the period being described in the movie?
No, I don't ever, I don't, I, you know, I don't really usually use the music in a way that connects too literally with what's happening in the story. And I also think the movie is sort of a fable in a way. The clothes that the people wear and the design of the sets and things, it doesn't really reflect anything in reality exactly. It's slightly off reality. I think it kind of lets the movie have a, it kind of gives it a sort of tone where it has its own logic and things where you might in real life say, well, they would never let him do that. He would never be able to get away with that. In this world, they sort of make sense. They're sort of logical.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the new movie comedy Rushmore. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the new movie comedy Rushmore, and he also co-wrote and directed the film Bottle Rocket. I want to ask you about your first movie, Bottle Rocket. It's about two good friends and their buddy who are starting to pull off these robberies, inspired by one of the friends who has probably watched a lot of movies and TV shows, but he wants to pull off these robberies like they do in the movies, like they do in heist movies. And he wants the secret signals and the detailed plans and the orders that he gives everybody. What inspired this story?
Well, the actual characters was mostly inspired by people we knew and kind of the friendships among our gang in Texas at that time. And so the story was originally not, I think the heart of the story is not it's not a crime kind of story. The crime stuff was something, the way they have the secret signals and the safe crackers and all that kind of stuff is about, that's the same way that we're interested in crime as something from movies. So that way, you know, there's a big robbery at the end of the movie, and for me, the main reason that robbery even exists is so that we can have a chance for the characters to throw smoke bombs, really. And there's another scene where they rob a bookstore, which that's just really, I worked at this bookstore, and I always thought, God, it would be so easy to rob this place. So that's how we end up having them rob a bookstore. And when they rob the bookstore, they wear these pieces of tape on their nose, which are their disguises. And that came from this TV show called Del Vecchio that Judd Hirsch was in, where there was a scene where these guys had mugged this old woman, but she couldn't identify any of them because they had tape on their nose and it distracted her. And at the end of the thing, Judd Hirsch has this great idea that he brings everyone in for a lineup, and she can't tell who's who, and then he tells them all to put tape on their nose, and then she can pick the guy. Exactly. So those were sort of those were our influences. So,
was the idea here to create characters who borrowed too much from movies and TV shows?
Yes, I think they borrowed way too much from. We probably borrowed too much, and so did they.
Now, did you do that in your life? Were there characters or particular movies that you imitated?
There are movies that we've all seen a million times that we're sort of almost unconsciously quoting, regularly. And then some of the characters in the movie are just are just our friends playing themselves. Like, there's one character, this guy named Kumar, who's this old Indian, kind of older Indian man, who we've used in both Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. And he's our friend who teaches yoga and lives above this coffee shop that his son owned in Dallas. And he just, you know, was someone we knew well, and always, you know, anytime we're thinking of a story, he's one of the first things we come up with is, what is Kumar going to play?
In Bottle Rocket, the characters need some experience actually robbing a house, so they decide to rob the house of one of the guys who's doing the robbery. They decide to rob his mother's home, but he says that you can't rob his mother's earrings because he just gave it to her as a gift, and he makes a list of other things that no one is allowed to rob. And I want to play a scene in which he's just found out that his friend, who's the ringleader of this little group, actually did take the mother's earrings.
Man, you got another ball. Should I play your game?
The list, Dignan. I know you remember the list because you signed it. You signed it, things Dignan's not supposed to touch.
The thing is, I can't be sorting through all that in the middle of a burglary.
I don't care, okay? I bought the earrings for my mother on her birthday. I went down, I picked them out
Okay, one thing is, every valuable item in the house was on that list.
Hey, maybe we should have robbed your house. You ever think of that? No, I bet that never crossed your mind.
What inspired that scene and the whole idea of robbing your own family's home?
I think we wanted to sort of quietly reveal the fact that these thieves cannot be taken seriously. And we wanted to sort of do it in a kind of a left-handed way where it's unstated, but where you would suddenly realize what the situation was. Because they robbed the house, and then they sort of split up the loot and get ready to celebrate, and then over the course of a conversation, you don't even know what one of them's getting upset about, and slowly you begin to realize what's happening. And I think it kind of, at the moment when you realize that that's what the robbery was, robbing their own house, and that it was very regulated, they were only supposed to steal things that were basically that wouldn't be noticed, then I think you kind of get the tone of the movie and the kind of characters they are, and that it's not a gritty mean streets story of crime. It's kind of a more good natured. Although Mean Streets is a bad example, because Mean Streets is actually about, you know, his own Scorsese's own experiences with these guys he knew in his neighborhood. So it's more like a Mean Streets kind of thing. But you can just know that it's not a true story about guys who are criminals. It's a story about some guys who grew up in some neighborhood together and ran around in each other's backyards.
Did you see Mean Streets and think, now how does this apply to me in my suburban Texas neighborhood?
Well, Mean Streets is a movie that Owen and I both always loved, but we have, you know, there's not much, you know, it's such a foreign place. It's like a foreign film for us, kind of. But I think it influenced us in terms of the way it tells a very personal story, and he kind of finds a sort of style in which he can tell, you know, it's almost a sort of a documentary about his neighborhood and certain people that grew up there, and then he's kind of found a way to make it into a dramatic movie.
Did you ever steal things when you were a teenager and think it was really cool?
I never even stole a pair of scissors when I was a teenager. I was extremely uptight about that.
Did you have friends who did?
Yeah, but I was like a very righteous teenager, and kind of humorless.
Humorless.
In some ways, I mean, when I look back, I just don't understand who I was. I feel so alienated from that person. I feel like I was a real stick in the mud.
What was the turning point for you of becoming who it is that you are now?
It was probably. It was probably some movie. I can't think of what movie it would have been. It's probably some movie where I started thinking, you know, that's really what I want to be more like. It was probably like some kind of Catcher in the Rye experience or something, you know.
Yeah, it's really hard to change who you are deep down, no matter how good the movie is.
Yeah, yeah, but maybe a book can do it.
Maybe a book. there you go. I read someplace that you made Super 8 movies when you were a kid.
Yeah. My father gave me a Super 8 camera when I was about 8 or 9. And My brothers and I made just about 100 Super 8s over the years.
What kind of movies were they?
Well, there was a long series of Indiana Jones movies. Indiana Jones in different countries going after different artifacts. And then there were a lot of private investigator stories. What else? We had one that was basically about a volcano going off, and it was animated with models, and it was that kind of thing. We had a Lego science fiction movie with little Lego spaceships exploding and that kind of thing.
Did any adults see those Super 8s and think, the kids got talent?
Well, I don't know if people were thinking that I had talent, but we were relentlessly showing those movies to anyone who would watch them. We had regular screenings. We would sometimes charge admission.
Really? Who would pay besides friends and family who felt obliged?
That's it.
Right. And you were spared the embarrassment of reviews, right?
Right. We only got encouragement.
When you were a kid, did you go to see kid movies or did you go see adult movies? And what were the kid movies like when you were young?
Well, you know, the movies we really loved, we loved the Pink Panther movies back then. And we loved, and there was other two, like the Bad News Bears movies, there was a whole series of those. The first one was really good and the other ones didn't really live up to the title. But there were a bunch of good Disney movies at that time. And there was one called Candleshoe with Jodie Foster that I really loved. And I think the movies that kind of, and maybe this ways that those movies might influence a movie like this, especially a movie like that, like Candleshoe, there's sort of a mystery in a movie like that, and a way that you sort of, are kind of like when you read a novel when you're 14 years old or 12 years old, you sort of get into the world of the novel and you're more committed to that world and get sort of lost in that world in a way that's sort of hard to do later in your life, kind of. And I sort of had the same experience with some movies where you just give yourself completely over and get submerged into it, kind of.
Do you know what your next movie is going to be?
Yeah, then our next movie, that's a script that Owen and I are working on now, and it's set in New York, and it's about a family of geniuses. And it's a large ensemble cast, and we're just getting rolling on it. Hopefully we'll be shooting it around the end of the year.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Terry.
Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the films Rushmore and Bottle Rocket. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze, showing off their silver leaves.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Airline travel for Fresh Air made possible by the generous support of United Airlines. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Elmore Leonard tells us about Be Cool, his new sequel to Get Shorty. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Charlotte Gray, the new book by Sebastian Fox, set during World War II. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elmore Leonard is on a winning streak. The recent movies Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight were adapted from his novels and won him new audiences, although he was already no stranger to the bestseller list. His new book is a sequel to Get Shorty, so let's start there. The film adaptation of Get Shorty starred John Travolta as Chili Palmer, a loan shark sent to Los Angeles to collect a gambling debt from Harry Zim, a B-movie producer played by Gene Hackman. Palmer follows Zim and breaks into the home of the producer's girlfriend, Karen Flores, played by Renee Russo. In this scene, Palmer tries to muscle the money from Zim.
Harry, a marker is like a check.
I know what a marker is.
They don't want to deposit yours and have a bounce. That annoys them. And your dear friend, Dick Allen's been calling you, leaving messages on your machine, and you haven't gotten back to him. So he asked me as a favor to look you up. So I follow you here, and I see you in a window with a woman. Looks a lot like Karen Flores, the actress from Grotesque. You're not looking at me, Harry.
Why do I have to keep looking at you?
Because I want you to.
So now you're gonna get rough, huh? I make good by tomorrow, you're gonna break my legs.
Come on, Harry, maces.
You tell Dick Allen I'll cover those markers in the next 60 days at the most. If he doesn't like it, then that's his problem. So, you want me to call you a cab?
So you make movies, huh?
I produce feature motion pictures, no TV. You mentioned Grotesque before. That happens to be Grotesque Part 2 that Karen Flores was in. She also starred in three of my Slime Creatures releases. You may have seen them.
I got an idea for a movie.
When Chili Palmer returns in Leonard's new novel, Be Cool, he has two films under his belt, the hit Get Leo and the flop Get Lost. Now he's ready to make his third movie about a rock singer who wants to be a star. One of the things that you're famous for as a writer, and this is the thing I think that makes your novels so great to adapt into screenplays, is your dialogue. It's lively, it's colorful, it's funny, and it reveals a lot about the people who are speaking it. There's a paragraph I'm going to read. It's a small thing I want to point out here, but I just really like it a lot. Let me get to the page. Okay, this is a scene in which a few of the characters are driving to a club that has swing bands performing. And I'll just pick it up here. Elliot said, guys went in there to shoot pool, and at night they had swing bands performed. One of them, Johnny Crawford, the kid that used to be on The Rifleman on TV, Chuck Connors' kid. Elliot hadn't seen the series. It was before his time, but he knew about it. Raji couldn't remember if he'd seen it or not when it was on, but he said, yeah, The Rifleman. It wasn't bad for what it was. You know what I'm saying? And I love that, the guy who can't remember it all.
Yeah,
he says, yeah, it wasn't bad for what it was. You know what I'm saying? There's something so perfect about that. It's kind of like fooling himself and fooling the other people.
Yeah, Raji probably believes what he said. Yeah, he's loaded with confidence, which is just, you know, baloney. Just, he's a street talker.
And I love the way you added the "you know what I'm saying," because to be speaking about something you know nothing about, and then ask for that's true, isn't it? You know, from somebody else, it's great.
Because I know that I'm going to move my stories with as much dialogue as possible, and this goes way back. I've always paid attention to dialogue. I've always listened. I've always made sure that each character has a different sound, an identifiable sound.
I think it's really good the way you capture somebody faking it in their dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Now, I try not to use any adverbs to let you know exactly how they're saying it, you know, because mm-hmm. I feel, well, if I've presented the character properly, you know what he sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and you know when he's being truthful, and you know when he's being sarcastic, and you know when he's honest. So I rely on my development of the character to keep me from using adverbs.
Now, you have pages that are just dialogue. There's really no, exposition outside of the dialogue. And I think when you write a lot of dialogue, you get into a lot of substitutions for he said and she said. You know, he retorted, she opined, he rebuked her. And I think you try to stay away from that.
Far away.
Yeah, and sometimes...
I use only said.
You use only said, and sometimes there isn't even an annotation of who's speaking. And so you really have to keep track, because there's a new paragraph, but it doesn't say who the speaker was each time somebody speaks. And tell me why you do that, why you don't always say who is speaking.
Well, more often than not, the he said is put in for a pause, a beat, rather than for identification. Because if just two people are speaking, they're alternating, the lines alternate. You know, this guy and then this guy. When you have three people talking, it becomes very difficult. Just one more character, and it compounds the problem of identification. And then you have many more he saids, she saids in it. I learned something from Raymond Carver about he said, using the verb said, and very very often he Carver would use within a paragraph said two or even three times. And you know it's not for identification. It's continuing. The dialogue is continuing. But it's in there for a beat, beats. So you'll just pause a moment before the next, a bigger beat than a period, you know.
Now, you don't have to worry about the he said type of thing if you're writing a screenplay. It's just the person speaking, a colon, and then the dialogue they speak.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Do you like
that?
That's
right. Well, I don't like writing screenplays, so I stopped doing it. I had to write screenplays, but selling my material to having it optioned and bought in Hollywood and then writing screenplays supported my book writing for 15 to 20 years. But finally, I got to the point where I didn't have to write screenplays, so I didn't have to listen to all the various ideas that came off the tops of heads at story conferences, and I could just go home then, I mean sit home then and write my book without anyone telling me what to do, and knowing that it's going to sell, I mean knowing at least that the publisher's going to buy it, and knowing that my editor likes what I do, and knowing that I get more satisfaction out of writing a book than I ever will a screenplay, that was a simple decision to make.
If there weren't people telling you what to do in the movie world, and if you had complete independence, would you want to write more screenplays? And I ask that because in some ways you seem perfect for the part, since screenplays are dialogue, and that's something you're so good at.
I know, but it's deceiving, because when you take my manuscript, 350-page manuscript, and you bring it down to 120-page shooting script, an awful lot of the good stuff's gone. You come down to plot. And this is what interests Hollywood, plot. And plot, to me, is not what makes my book move. It's the characters. The characters are the most important element, how they interact, who they are, what they think, even little set pieces, things that are part of their backstories. Those are all much more interesting to me than what's going to happen. Although I know by now how to write it in such a way that you leave off before something happens and you go to another scene. I mean, in a way, it's kind of a movie in a movie format. You know, that you end with a question. You don't really know what what happens is not the most important thing about the book. It's how they get there. Mm-hmm. It's the ride, not finally where you arrive at.
In your three recent movies, Get Shorty, Jackie Brown, and Out of Sight, did you work on the screenplays at all?
No, I didn't. I did Scott Frank, who's up for an award for Out of Sight, an Oscar. He and I disagreed on certain things, because he would call me while we became friends when he was doing, when they were shooting Get Shorty.
I'll just say he wrote the screen adaptation of Out of Sight.
Mm-hmm. And And because we were friends now, then he would call me up when he was writing out of sight and tell me where he was having problems or just in general what he was doing. And a couple of places we disagreed. The Albert Brooks character, for example, in the movie, he wanted to bring in and do scenes with him, whereas in the book he's only in a backstory. He's only told about. And I said, I don't think that it's necessary to bring the character in. The fact that there's a lot of money at his house, that is the pie in the sky for the characters who want to go and steal it. And that's all really you need. And I didn't agree with his idea for the ending, where because I said it's the woman's, it's the federal marshal, it's her story, not his. And I think you should end with her and her attitude about the affair she had with him. And Scott Frank said, yeah, well, it's her book, but it's his movie because he's George Clooney, and he's going to sell more tickets than Jennifer Lopez. But neither one of them sold that many tickets. But and he was right. He was right about the ending, and he was right about Albert Brooks' presence in the movie. And I think it worked, and I told him.
My guest is Elmore Leonard. His new novel, Be Cool, is a sequel to Get Shorty. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elmore Leonard. His new novel, Be Cool, is a sequel to Get Shorty. Now let me ask you about the screen adaptation of Rum Punch, which was Quentin Tarantino's movie, Jackie Brown.
Yeah.
This is one of those rare times in movie history when the novel has a pretty happy ending, where the man and the woman get together. And in Jackie Brown, the movie adaptation, they don't get together.
Well, I'm not sure that in the book that they get together. I think there's a possibility, but it's still up in the air. Is he going to go with her or not? She's got all the money in the car, and is he going to go with her? I don't think it's that clear in the book, because I wasn't sure myself.
You're the guy who knows, so I defer to you on this one.
I remember when my editor at Delacorte read the manuscript, and she said, you know, it ends awfully abruptly. I said, I know it does, but it's over. And she said, well, why don't you just let it coast a little bit, just a, you know, a page or so, but without adding any new material, which I did. So then I took the 2 pages, the final 2 pages, and rewrote them as 3 pages and just kind of, I don't know exactly what I did, but it didn't have the same. It still has kind of an abrupt feeling, but it wasn't as abrupt as the original manuscript. In the screen version now, which I think is the most closely adapted of any of mine that have been made into movies, that Quentin's screenplay expanded a little bit on scenes. He took his time with it. He told me this is what he was going to do, that the first half of the picture is getting to know the characters, and then finally we will get him into action. And I resented the fact that some of the critics said, well, it's too long. Well, too long, it wasn't too long for Quentin, and he's the one who's making the picture. This is his movie, you know? It's like a painting. It's like looking at a painting on a wall. It's, oh, well, it's too wide. You ought to cut about 2 feet off the right-hand side. You know, this is the artist's, this is his baby. This is what he did, what he's proud of. And I thought the movie was great. I loved it.
I loved it, too. one of the really nice things about the movie is, you know, the two romantic leads in it are Robert Forster and Pam Grier. And, you know, they're both, you know, middle-aged. They'd be over the hill by Hollywood standards, right?
Yeah.
And there's something just, like, so touching about the relationship of these two really hard-boiled people with each other.
Well, that was the idea, that it is a romance. He called me 2 years before he started. He was going to do a book of mine called Kill Shot, but then he called me up and said, I've decided to do Rum Punch because it's the best woman's part I've seen in a long time. And he had already thought of Robert Forster for the bail bondsman. Didn't mention Pam Grier. And so he must have had her in mind, but he didn't want to spring that on me, I don't think, yet. Because then, just before he went into production, he called me up and said, I've been afraid to call you for the last year. And I said, why? Because you're changing the title and you're making the lead a black woman? And he said, yeah. I said, well, I like Pam Grier and I like your movies, so go ahead, do whatever you want. You know, it's in your hands. I'm not going to make any suggestions.
Is there a scene in any of the recent film adaptations of your novels where you particularly like hearing the actor doing lines that are straight out of your book?
Yeah, in Jackie Brown, when Sam Jackson was trying to get, I forgot who it was, to get into the trunk of the car. And Quentin liked that so much he even elaborated on it. The scene is longer in the movie than it is in the book. It's usually the other way around. I thought that worked extremely well.
What did you like about it?
Well, I just felt that these two guys were really into it. I mean, they were really doing it. They were really those characters. It was so believable to me.
And how much of that was improvised? How much of it came right out of the book?
Well, I was on the set when they were shooting that scene, and they started to improvise, and Quentin said, "No, stay with the lines as they're written. You can improvise later," and he made sure that the characters stayed with his dialogue. Then he would let them try things. And it was the same way with Barry Sonnenfeld in Get Shorty. The actors had to stay with the words as written. Because what happens is when actors begin to make up their own lines, they're usually lines that you thought of and discarded as being trite or too obvious. And it's funny, in story meetings, the studio executive will come up with this, what he thinks is a great idea, and he doesn't realize that in writing a book over a period of 6 or 7 months, that you've thought of all these ideas, and you discarded them, and you've come up with what you believe is the best idea to make the story work, you know?
I'm going to play some of that scene with Samuel Jackson getting Chris Tucker into the trunk from Jackie Brown. The language is filled with expletives, which we're going to have to bleep out. How come you use so many expletives in your dialogue?
Because that's the way those people talk. I remember my mother saying, oh, that's terrible. I said, Mother, I don't talk like that, but they do. What am I going to do? I mean, it's a fact, but I think it really does spark it up, though. There's no question about it. It's not descriptive at all. You know, it's just they're sounds, but they're emphatic sounds.
Here's Samuel Jackson getting Chris Tucker into the trunk with lots of expletives from Jackie Brown. Elmer Leonard, thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
Man, you must be out of your f***ing mind if you think I'm gonna get in this dirty-ass trunk.
We ain't going nowhere but to Koreatown, man. You ain't gonna be in here no more than 10 minutes.
Man, I ain't riding in no trunk for no minute, man. Well, I can't ride up front with you.
You can't ride up front with me. The surprise element is 90% of it.
I'm sorry, man, but I ain't getting no trunk.
I can't believe you do me like this.
Do you like what, man? I just ain't climbing in no...
Elmore Leonard's new novel is called Be Cool. Screenwriter Scott Frank has received an Academy Award nomination for his adaptation of Leonard's novel Out of Sight. Here's George Clooney in a scene from the film.
Who can I help you, sir?
You see the man talking to your bank manager has his case open.
Oh, that's Mr. Gwendon, one of our assistant managers. Our manager is Mr. Schoen, but he's not in today.
But you see the man with the briefcase?
Yes.
That's my partner. He has a gun in there. If you don't do exactly what I tell you, or if you give me any kind of a problem at all, I'm going to look over at my partner, and he's going to shoot your Mr. Gwendon between the eyes. All right, now take one of those big envelopes and put as many hundreds, fifties, and twenties as you can pack into it. Nothing with bank straps or rubber bands. I don't want any dive packs. I don't want any bait money. Start with the second drawer and then the one over there underneath the money counter. Is this your first time being around? Yeah, you're doing great. Just smile, Loretta, so you don't look like you're being held up. I had to give my partner a sign. Now that's good. Now he's going to wait 30 seconds until I'm out of the building. Make sure you haven't set off the alarm. If you have, he's going to shoot you, Mr. Gwendon, between the eyes. Okay? I think that'll do it, Loretta. Thank you. Nice day.
You too.
It's your thing. Do what you want to do. I can't tell you.
Coming up, a review of a new novel by Sebastian Faulk set in World War II. This is Fresh Air. Sebastian Faulk has just published a new novel called Charlotte Gray. It's the last in a trilogy of novels about France, which includes the bestseller about World War I, Birdsong. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that with his new novel, Faulk has written himself into hostile territory for his imagination.
2 summers ago, I took my first trip to Paris. Of course, I saw a few museums and cathedrals, but I would have managed to see even more sights if I hadn't squandered valuable hours browsing around in, what else, bookstores. I particularly remember one damp, happy afternoon spent in the English language bookstore called the Village Voice. I was rooting around a table filled with new paperbacks, and I picked up Birdsong, Sebastian Faulk's much-acclaimed novel about World War I, partly set in the bloody trenches of France. "C'est magnifique!" exclaimed the bookstore clerk, and then she smiled and nodded her head up and down vigorously at me when she saw that even that elementary French phrase struck fear into my heart. I bought that paperback edition of Birdsong, even though I was pretty certain that the hardcover was buried in my must-read pile back home, because I was so grateful for that moment of communion between book lovers who didn't speak the same language. Well, I don't think they'll be recommending Faulk's new novel, Charlotte Gray, at the Village Voice or any other bookstore in Paris this year. The strongest aspect of this very uneven novel is its nuanced rendering of realpolitik in France during the German occupation, and the account isn't flattering to the French. While Faulk does scatter a few resistance fighters in black berets throughout his story, most of his ordinary French characters direct their contempt not at the Germans, but at Jews, the English, and homegrown communists. In the pragmatic view of the French person in the street here, the Vichy government represents the last stand against Bolshevism. As one character puts it, being occupied by a well-behaved foreign power would enable France to put in place, peacefully, the conservative internal reforms it had long needed. Unfortunately, the political picture Faulx paints of wartime France is just about the only part of his novel that doesn't succumb to stereotype. In fact, long stretches of Charlotte Gray read like Danielle Steele goes to war. The novel opens in early 1942. Night has fallen, and a daredevil RAF airman named Peter Gregory is climbing into his Spitfire, off to fly yet another bombing run over France. Meanwhile, at a train station in Scotland, a young woman named Charlotte Gray bids her mother farewell as she leaves for London to find some kind of work to help the war effort. You guessed it. Peter and Charlotte meet and fall in love. Then his plane is downed behind enemy lines, and Charlotte, whose fluent French has qualified her as a courier for some very hush-hush military intelligence agency, resolves to sneak into France to rescue him. Faulx's language is as melodramatic as his plot. Before flying his last mission, Peter suffers an attack of nerves, and we're told that he had not been able to absorb as well as he had thought the things the last 2 years had shown him. He was still young, and he had seen in that short time things that normally only old men knew. And then there had come this woman. Listen, at the end of that passage, you can hear the made-for-TV miniseries soundtrack clashing to crescendo right before the commercial break. I'll read almost any story about World War II, and Charlotte Gray certainly isn't the silliest I've sped through. But what happened to Sebastian Faulx? Birdsong was so discerning, so finely imagined, so unexpected. Occasionally, you sense Faulx's old writerly intelligence at work here, but mostly, in the hackneyed parlance of this novel, it's gone missing. Maybe World War II just isn't Faulx's war. It's a lit crit commonplace to say that World War I inspired great poetry, while the Second World War produced great prose. Birdsong was a great poetic novel. I'm afraid Charlotte Gray is merely prosaic.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Charlotte Gray by Sebastian Faulx. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Little Brown & Company, publisher of The Year 1000, What Life Was Like at the Turn of the First Millennium, An Englishman's World, by Robert Lacey and Danny Danziger, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.